It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The institution of the American shopping mall is dying. At least one could be forgiven for thinking so when you look across the landscape of malls in Illinois. In Springfield, White Oaks Mall is losing the last of its traditional anchor stores as the Macy's closes down. In Bloomington Normal, Eastland Mall has just a fraction of the stores from its peak. And in the far south suburbs of Chicago, the mall where I hung out from time to time as a kid, Lincoln Mall, is gone. Like, gone. A series of empty parking lots that would make a great filming location for a post-apocalyptic thriller. Speaking of that, malls have become a cultural icon. Take the 1978 movie Dawn of the Dead, where the survivors of a zombie apocalypse take shelter inside a shopping mall.
What the hell is it?
Looks like a shopping center, one of those big indoor malls.
Stuff from which nightmares are made. All that said, my next guest might argue, to paraphrase Mark Twain, that reports of the death of the American shopping mall have been greatly exaggerated. And beyond that, places like the mall can play a major role in how we connect with one another. Alexandra Lang is an architecture and design critic. She's a columnist for Bloomberg City Lab, and she's written for many other publications. She's also the author of several books, including most recently Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. She joins me now. Alexandra, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can join us today for the rest of the hour by calling 800-222-9455. When's the last time you went to the mall? What does the mall look like in your part of Illinois? Is it thriving? Is it dying? What do you think about efforts to revitalize malls? Maybe you see something where you live. Let us know at 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. All right, Alexandra, the word mall, the concept of the mall, can conjure up a lot of different mental images. From your standpoint, what are the essential elements of a mall?
Let's see. Historically, the essential elements of a mall were having two department stores at either end, the anchor stores, and a line of shops in between, and that the whole thing would be under one roof.
Well, that's a pretty simple definition. Does it? So it has to be indoors? Outdoor malls don't count? Or does that, is there, how do you think of that?
Technically, a mall is an indoor mall. Now, you know, as malls kind of more have morphed and changed in the late 20th century, I think there are a number of things that have outdoor space that you would call a mall. But technically, like the indoorness is part of the definition of a mall. And that's what separates it, from a strip mall or a shopping center, as some outdoor places are sometimes called.
I like that indoorness of it. All right. So the history of the mall, as I understand it, it runs through the Midwest. The first fully enclosed mall opened in Minnesota, 1956. Talk about, you know, the concept of the modern American mall. What problem was it trying to solve?
Yeah, so the man who's generally considered to be the father of the American shopping mall was actually a Viennese emigre named Victor Gruen. And Gruen came to the U.S. in the late 30s, fleeing the Nazis. And he started working designing shops and department stores. And then in the post-war era, he realized that the, you know, largely subsidized by the American government, we were building all of these new suburbs. But the suburbs were houses and they were roads and, you know, schools, but there was no real place for people to go. And he had this memory of kind of the conviviality of the streets of Vienna, the town centers in Europe. And he thought, what if I could build that kind of town center in the suburbs? And the way he came up to build it was the shopping mall. And he designed the first shopping mall, which, yes, opened in 1956 in Edina, Minnesota, which is a suburb of Minneapolis.
And one of the things that I think mall people know about is the Gruen transfer. Can you talk about that idea of name for him? Yeah.
Yes, the Gruen transfer. I love the concept of the Gruen transfer because it's an experience that I think almost all of us have had. But yes, there's a technical term for it. The Gruen transfer is that moment when you're at the mall and maybe you came in with a shopping list and specific stores you wanted to go to, but your mind kind of takes off from that place and you're just enjoying the experience of being in the mall and you kind of just like kind of let yourself drift. In the shopping atmosphere.
And how well or not well did these malls sort of meet this ideal that he had of the, you know, the European town square as but in the form of the American shopping mall?
Well, I think initially they met it very well. I mean, malls were super successful for a very long time. What Gruen didn't anticipate was some of the add-on urbanism and the extent to which malls would kind of take off as a business and really drain the life from a lot of main streets and downtowns. Towards the end of his life in the 70s, Gruen, moved back from Europe and really tried to disavow the mall as his creation. But I would say initially, let's say the heyday first 20 years of malls, they really did fulfill that community function. And I think in a lot of places, they're still fulfilling that community function of giving people a place to go, especially on the weekends, especially potentially, for kids who don't have a lot of other choices.
Yeah, and yet, I mean, so there are these semi-public or quasi-public spaces, and yet they are privately owned properties. One of our producers was sharing a story from her undergraduate days as a student journalist where she tried to go interview shoppers at a mall about the news of the day and got kicked out. So maybe you could just talk a little bit about that, you know, this idea of a public space with private ownership, though.
Yeah, no, and that has been an issue for malls since the late 60s. Kind of to what extent are they a public space? To what extent are they covered by free speech rules, general assembly rules, and what are the parameters of how they can kick people out of the mall? In the case of the student journalist, I mean, malls are a private space, but because they kind of stepped into the breach in this way in the suburbs of providing a central place for people to go, they tend to be perceived as public. And a lot of malls go to a lot of lengths to, encourage the public to think of them that way. But yes, the mall ownership can always set the underlying rules of who is and is not allowed to come in. And in a lot of places, that brushes up against some problems. I've been doing some interviews recently about all of the parental escort policies and curfews that have been instituted at malls that basically exclude teenagers in the evening or exclude teenagers without parental escorts. And right, that's the kind of thing that can't happen on most city streets, but it can happen at a mall.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. That actually is a good question. Are there do, does it are there implications of free speech or free assembly? Like you said, they're private spaces, but they're public accommodation laws. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there definitely are those issues. There was a Supreme Court case in the 1980s. I think Pruneyard was the plaintiff that basically kicked the question of whether malls had to allow free assembly back to the states. So now, in some states, you are allowed to protest at the mall, and in other states, you cannot protest at the mall. And for example, during the Black Lives Matter protests, there was a protest at the Mall of America, and all of those protesters were arrested. And well, some were arrested, all were kicked out because in Minnesota, you cannot freely assemble at the mall for protest.
Fascinating. All right, let me reintroduce our conversation. If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st show. We are talking about the life, the many deaths, and we'll get to the rebirths of the American shopping mall in our society since the 1950s. My guest is Alexandra Lang, an architecture and design critic and author of Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. It's available now from Bloomsbury Publishing. You can join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, so where does the mall start to go wrong? I was born in the mid 1970s. I was a teenager in the, I guess, very late 80s, early 1990s. Malls were still seeming to do pretty good at that era. When do things start to turn south?
Things start to turn south in the mid 1990s. So I would say we're basically contemporary. So like after our childhoods. And that is really a function of the U.S. starting to get over-malled, as people call it. In the United States, there is kind of wildly more retail square footage per capita than in most other industrialized nations. And so those malls started to cannibalize each other's business. And so you get a town that maybe has, you know, four malls on the outskirts, and people start flocking to the newest one, and the oldest one starts to look a little tired, can't get the national chains in there, et cetera, et cetera. And so that mall goes out of business. And you first started to see that in the 1990s. But I would say the kind of big historical event that we're still dealing with now in terms of mall business was the 2008 recession, which took out a lot more malls.
And I would imagine the dot-com boom plays some role in this, right? People using malls as showrooms, and then they go buy it on Amazon or some other site like that.
It plays some role, but honestly, not as much as you would think. Let's see, I'm trying to remember the percentages. The percentage of online shopping as like in terms of total retail before the pandemic was about like 21%, and that zoomed up to about 32% during COVID-19 pandemic. But that has now, that number has started to go down again as people return to shopping in person. So I would say, you know, online shopping is a contributing factor, but it's probably not the major factor.
Interesting. What about the question of, you mentioned curfews, and one of the reasons, and you know, sort of policies about unaccompanied minors or teenagers, one of the reasons I think those are in place is you have seen, you know, there's a history of violence at shopping malls, either fighting at, you know, the sort of like ordinary end of the spectrum all the way up to mass shootings. Is violence a part of this story at all, big picture?
I think there's been an increase in violence in our society in general, and malls are reflective of that. And because they serve as a public space, they're often the forum for that. But I don't think there's anything specific to malls that, you know, kind of makes them a violent space. In fact, many malls have an anti-weapons policy, you know, kind of more stringent than the communities that they're in. I think the issue in the past few years in terms of fighting in teenagers has been that those fights get filmed and are circulated on TikTok. So it actually seems like there are more fights happening and more fights closer to you than there actually are. Because I've gone looking several times to see if there was actually an increase in, you know, teenagers fighting in malls, and I've never been able to find statistics that support that.
That is such a good point, and that's true of so many things in our modern discourse. That is it actually happening more, or are we just seeing it more because of the ubiquity of social media and smartphone cameras all around
us?
Yeah. So okay, so malls are they've sort of hit a low point. What do you see people doing to try and stave off the destruction? I mentioned the Lincoln Mall in the South Suburbs of Chicago, which is now just an empty series of parking lots and a concrete slab where the buildings used to be, all the way up to some malls are still doing very well. What do people do to try and to sort of reckon with malls that are not living up to what they used to be?
Yeah. And in my reporting, I found a lot of creative solutions to these problems. I mean, one of the things that I was really interested in trying to do with the book was, you know, not have it end on this note of, you know, dead malls, malls are over, but to say, okay, like we have these malls, we actually, you know, can't and shouldn't keep them all because of the kind of oversaturation. So what are some creative solutions? And I would say, you know, a mall like the one you mentioned on the south side, that is just has been a cleared site. I think mall parking lots, whether the mall is there or not, can be a great place to build new housing. You know, we're in a housing crisis across the U.S., and many malls are very well located in terms of like road access, and they are already part of residential communities in a sense. So why not build housing in the mall parking lots? It's even better if some part of the mall still exists, because then the residents of that housing can access the stores. And there's some examples of successful malls like Garden State Plaza that are actually kind of proactively adding housing to become more of a literal town center with a little green and the housing and the existing mall. Let's see. I think you mentioned another mall where it's the Macy's that's closing.
Yeah, well, this is Springfield, and that's a really interesting case, but go ahead.
No, I was just going to say another reason for the downfall of the mall is actually post 2008, the downfall of department stores in general, which I think, everyone can see in their community. There was a tremendous sort of reconcentration of department stores as just a couple of brands, but also their sales really fell off and were kind of gutted by post 2008 income inequality. So like the department stores that tend to be doing better are the higher end department stores, and people who used to shop at places like Macy's are instead shopping at like Target and Kohl's and Burlington Coat Factory, more discount retailers. And those department stores were such a part of the identity of the mall, and often literally as anchor stores, they were the stores that allowed the mall to exist. So those are big holes. And there are a lot of different things that people are using to fill the holes. And they can be everything from medical offices that then also, feed people to the businesses in the mall. I'm seeing a lot of entertainment businesses like family entertainment, trampoline parks, movie theaters, things like that. And the third thing that you see in a lot of places is food uses, kind of high-end, food courts or food halls, gourmet grocery stores like Trader Joe's and things like that, that people still, have to leave their houses to get and actually enjoy being around.
Yeah, the grocery store sounds particularly brilliant because people have to go to grocery, well, most people have to, if they can, go to grocery stores multiple times a week. So you are bringing a lot of traffic in. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to talk more about some of the rebirth of American malls and how some of the trends that we just heard Alexandra Lang talking about are and are not playing out in different parts of Illinois. This is The 21st Show. You can join us at 800-222-9455. We'll be right back. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the life and death and rebirth of the American shopping mall in our society. My guest is Alexandra Lang, an architecture and design critic, a columnist at Bloomberg, and Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall, is her most recent book. You can get that now from Bloomsbury Publishing. What are your memories of shopping malls? What are the malls looking like? Are you somebody who still goes to the mall? What does the mall look like in your part of Illinois? We'd love to hear it. There are thriving malls out there, and there are also malls that look like ghost towns. 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. So, Alexandra, I want to bounce off you what is happening in Springfield with the mall there, because I have some pretty decent knowledge of the situation, and see how it does or does not exemplify some of the trends you were talking about before the break. So it used to be four big anchor stores. This is a classic sort of American mall. It was a Macy's and their predecessor company, a Bergner's. There was a Sears with, full automotive and everything else. And I think it was a Montgomery Ward. That was more than 20 years ago that closed. It's now a fitness center and a couple of big box stores, one of which doesn't even go into the mall. The Macy's, as I said, is on its way out. The Bergner's has been converted into a place that's called Malibu Jack's, which has like bowling and go-karts and arcades and stuff. And the Sears, this is the odd one out, is going to be the headquarters of the Illinois EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency in the state. So I wonder if you can just sort of riff on what is happening there and how that does or does not fit into, best practices and trends you see around the country.
Yeah, wow, that's like a little of everything. I love it. That fits very well into the trends. Like you've got the family entertainment. You've got basically a lower priced general store. And you've got a kind of government reinvestment in the mall. An EPA office is not one that I've heard before. But as I mentioned, you see a lot of medical uses. I've also seen kind of university and community colleges going into malls, and also moving city offices and even public libraries into malls. So again, like a mall is a place where everybody knows where it is. It already has lots of parking. And so especially if you're kind of a consumer-facing government business, which I don't know if the EPA really is, it's a great place to locate, because you've already got the box for the location built. I guess I would say the only thing that Springfield is missing is, as I mentioned, food-related businesses are really popular. So if they want more kind of late afternoon, evening activity, weekend activity, I would say some kind of food hall, and that maybe also has like takeout options and food shopping options would probably be a good thing for them to look at.
Can you talk about the interface between malls and like new urbanism? Because one of the things, I mean, Springfield's mall is, since we're on this as an example, you can get to it by bus, but it is still surrounded by huge parking lots. Now, the EPA building has a big row of EV chargers outside, as you might expect for the Environmental Protection Agency building, but it is still very much centered around car culture. So, I mean, there's friction there, right, between the sort of new urbanism, people trying to revitalize downtown cores, and these, you know, malls, which are still on the outskirts of town and drawing people away from the center of the city.
Yeah, I mean, I think the geography of the mall centered in the middle of a parking lot, it makes it really, really difficult to link malls to, pedestrian and bicycle networks. But I don't think it's impossible. And as I said, like some malls are starting to add housing in their parking lots because they're realizing they don't need that much parking. They want to, kind of make more money over the real estate they already have. And one way in which, building new housing can help malls is by pushing those new buildings to the edge of the parking lot and making an actual kind of approachable street front, that then maybe gets a sidewalk, gets attached to bike lanes and other and pedestrian infrastructure that can lead back into the neighborhoods that are around the mall. I mean, if if you look at malls from above, often you can't walk from the residential areas to the mall. And so planners need to start thinking, how can we kind of break down some of these literal and psychological barriers and try to connect these malls to the housing and other things around them. I mean, also, like especially let's say malls in first ring suburbs, those first ring suburbs have gotten a lot denser than they were when those malls were built in, say, like the 70s or early 80s. So there may be a lot more opportunities and a lot more people living close to the mall, but that parking lot really forms this barrier to getting them in without driving.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point. I've often wondered about the, just the design of malls, the fact that cars can still drive around the edge of them. Why not have the parking sort of like dead end at the entrance of the mall so that you can't, mow down pedestrians in the perimeter of the mall? I don't know, we're getting a little far afield probably in what we're talking about. But let's talk about this idea, come back to this idea of the mall as the agora, right? As the community space. What do we lose? Would we really lose that much if these spaces were to kind of go away or really substantially, become all government buildings or something like that, where it's maybe not as inviting to hang out all the time?
I think so. I mean, you mentioned the Agora. So that's like the oldest citizen gathering space. And I think that, kind of the long history of such spaces, whether it's an agora or a market or a town square or a common, indicates that there is a basic human need to get together in person. And I think communities without a space in which people can do that casually, like, are lesser for it. So I think, you know, when people see a mall start to go downhill in their town, they're like, well, okay, what's going to replace it? Do we have, you know, a public park that has, you know, seating and a gathering space? Do we have any kind of central square, maybe outside a government building? And in a lot of places, they don't, because it wasn't really beneficial to residential developers to build those spaces. And they kind of assumed, I think, in many cases, that the government would step in and do it for them. Yeah, I think it can be really damaging to communities to lose their mall and not have that space. And it's important to think creatively about what places might replace it. I mean, you know, I'm always going to, you know, support a great public library or a great public park or a great town square over the privately owned public space of a mall. But a lot of places just don't have that option or don't have it. And so I think it's important to kind of recognize what you have.
You know, it's interesting. You're reminding me of, I think it was sociologist Eric Klinenberg a couple of books ago had one, Palaces for the People, where he talked about how there just isn't as much public investment in these sort of things as there used to be. You know, and gets into this idea of the third place. We're at a time now where we're seeing this push to, you know, or we may see a push to sort of scale back the public sector. Certainly in Washington, we're feeling that happening. I wonder how that relates to this history we've been talking about and the possible futures for our public spaces.
Yeah, no, that absolutely relates to it. And I love Eric Klinenberg's book, and I love that in some places the public library has moved into the mall, because I feel like that's a great partnership and a great way to, you know, kind of make the pu public library even more convenient for people. So there's synergies there. But yeah, I think third places, which is a concept, sort of a term coined by sociologist Ray Oldenburg, are really important. Those are places where you can go and see other people and kind of decide whether you want to engage or not. You know, you might have a chance encounter with somebody that you've only, you know, seen on the sidelines of the soccer field and actually have a conversation. And those are really important in terms of expanding people's networks, making people feel comfortable with each other. And I think it would be a real mistake, and kind of both psychologically and humanistically, for people to retreat to their homes and kind of their own tribes.
You know, where there's talk now of another recession potentially, and we don't have to get into sort of punditizing on the day's news, but I've been having this feeling. You know, Joann Fabrics going out of business, Macy's, you know, shutting down so many stores. It reminds me a little bit of what it felt like in 2007, 2008, when, you know, a lot of businesses I used to go to, Circuit City, Borders, pick your names, started going out. Do you get the sense that we may be on the cusp of another sort of major change in the American sort of shopping environment?
I do get that sense, and I am worried about it, because several of those businesses you mentioned, I think, are great examples of businesses that have a community around them. I mean, Borders was a great example of the third place, because yes, it was there to, you know, sell books and sell coffee, but a lot of people spent a lot of time hanging out there. And I think Joann Fabric is very similar. Like, I do some crafts, so I'm on some crafting subreddits, and like the amount of mourning for Joann Fabrics, just as like a relatively inexpensive place for people who, you know, quilt and knit and have their own, you know, kind of communities and crafting groups to go. Like, take that away, and they are really like wondering where they're going to go, because things like crafting and books, like, you want to see them and touch them and browse, and to not have that in-person experience is really damaging, you know, to the quality of the crafting, but also to the community that's grown up around that craft or book clubs or something like that. So yeah, I'm very worried about that. I think that's where, again, if you have strong public institutions, sometimes they can step in. You know, having you know, textile swap meets, having the public library rather than a private bookstore, et cetera. But if you don't have those things already in your community, you're either gonna have to look for that community online, or you're going to have to drive further, and fewer people can do that.
Last thing I want to ask you about, and we're running out of time, but, you know, the mall has had such an important role in pop culture. You know, we had that little clip from the zombie movie at the beginning of our conversation today. You know, I think of the movies that were maybe when we were younger, Mallrats, things like that, even Stranger Things. Wonder Woman 84 has a fight at the mall. You know, talk about the mall's place in our pop culture. Do you see it losing its hold as you know, new generations come up who haven't had that sort of formative experience that others might have?
I do see it losing its hold. I mean, so many of those movies, especially the 90s, 2000 movies, were teen movies. And it was like you couldn't have a teen movie without a scene of going to the mall in the movie. But if you look at more recent teen movies, the example I use is, now I'm forgetting the name. Oh my God. Anyway, sorry, I've completely blanked on the name.
No,
more
that's
recent
all
right. Teen movie that didn't have a mall scene, but instead had the teenagers basically like filming scenes in their own bedrooms and communicating on social media. So, like, the sort of location of teen socialization has become, you know, like TikTok and Snapchat and their own bedroom, which then they're sharing photos of. But that is a completely different experience from like actually running into each other in person at the mall. And so, yeah, I think the media really reflects the fact that that's no longer seen as an essential part of teen life.
Yeah, fascinating. All right. Well, it's been an interesting conversation. Alexandra Lang is an architecture and design critic. Her most recent book is Meet Me by the Fountain, an inside history of the mall. You can get it now from Bloomsbury Publishing or wherever you get your books. Alexandra, thanks for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to be speaking with Illinois Senate Republican leader John Curran about issues in the news, state budget, and other matters. That's coming up tomorrow. We'll also visit the Urbana Free Library and talk about an exhibit demonstrating what quantum technology looks like in action, and talk about the future of that field. That's all coming up tomorrow on the 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Visit our website, 21stshow.org, where you can find our past programs. You can find links to subscribe to our podcasts, or just look us up on Apple or Spotify or YouTube. You can find us there by searching Illinois Public Media. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.